Okay, good evening, everybody. You tune in to KC 107.7, the sound that sets you free. Now, KC is a child of democracy. KC was started 27 years ago, to be exact, and she is the collective community effort. Radio for us is community in conversation with itself, and so we welcome each and every one of you tonight to our third Courageous Conversation, and our first for 2023. Now, tonight we ask the question, you know, has freedom delivered on the promise? And we invited a panel of esteemed guests to share their views. We've also invited a studio audience to share their views and to raise questions of concern. And we only have 60 minutes to discuss a very deep topic. So the backdrop to this conversation really is that South Africa continues to be the most unequal country in the world. If there was a World Cup now, we would win, because that's what the World Bank said in 2022 in their report. Despite democracy, we're the most unequal country in the world. Poverty, unemployment, and inequality continues to hunt us by day and haunt us by night. Professor Sam-Peter Blanche in 2012 already said that our transformation efforts are quite frankly failing. And so we thought, in terms of the rules of this evening, in terms of our discussion, is that we don't want you to be politically correct. We want you to call a spade a spade. This is a safe space. Niemand gaat met elkaar bekleien. That's a safe space for you to talk. It's a space where we respect one another, to listen and to then have this conversation. So if you're joining us on Facebook, very welcome. If you're joining us on air, welcome. If we see that we're not going to exhaust the 60 minutes, we'll go off air at 8, but then we will continue the conversation on Facebook, say for 15 minutes, if it's okay with our panel. So let's get right into it and introduce our panel in no particular order. I'm going to ask each, I've sent them the questions, to please introduce themselves to me and to you, and then to answer what makes you proud to be South African, and what does freedom mean? And you only have a minute, eh? So introduce yourself. What does freedom mean to you? Should we start with you, Calvin? You're the closest to me.
Yeah, thank you.
And what makes you proud to be South African?
Good evening, Dr. Kluter, and the lovely audience here and your listeners. I was a born and bred son of the soil of Paul, not far from here. It is an extremely proud moment to deal with this vexing question, especially with my fellow participants here, because it's something that bothers me. One evening in one of the standing committees in Parliament, when I was struggling, you know, when you present to the AGS, the Auditor General, you struggle, and somebody came to me and said, "Comrade, take this water. We fought for freedom, but all we got is democracy." Mm. So fundamentally what he's saying, that the hunger to shed 400 years of slavery, of imperialism, of colonialism in the last, 60 years of apartheid, is a moment. There's a moment of freedom. But the formalization of that freedom into democracy, in political democracy, in the vote, in the institutions of democracy, that's what we're grappling with 29 years of the democracy. And for me, complete freedom is if we can, you know, match those two, if we can, you know, liberate ourselves both psychologically, both politically and economically, and deal with the most marginalized. If we have to answer what freedom is, obviously we miss that moment. But have freedom brought freedom and peace and democracy to those who sacrificed, to pay the ultimate price for this moment that we have achieved? That's the one point. The second point is, have the marginalized, the millions of people without water, without housing, without food, without electricity, have they been attaining the fruits of freedom? So that for me is the context of this discussion.
Thank you. So you would say it's not yet Uhuru?
In fact, I've written it down, not yet, Ureleta Mbulu.
Okay.
I always listen to that song when I'm despondent, but I have, you know, I'm a hopeful person.
Okay.
So I know we will overcome this as South Africans.
Thank you, Calvin. So Calvin, he didn't say this to you, but he's also the CEO of the castle in the city center. And that building always fascinates me, you know, to think that it really is here. So thank you very much, Calvin, for being with us tonight. Then we've got another guest.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kulute. Good evening to everyone, to all the listeners. So I'm Beverly Schaefer. I'm currently the Deputy Speaker of the Western Cape Provincial Parliament, a former Minister of Economic Development, Tourism and Agriculture, and been in politics since 2008. All that actually is irrelevant in this conversation, because I firstly just want to say that what makes me so proudly South African is the diversity. And when I think of the diversity, I think of the World Cup. I think of all the quirky people in our country. I think about, you know, when we had the World Cup and we had the Vuvuzelas, and we set a new trend in the world, actually. And that's parts that I am so immensely proud of and so immensely feel as one. We feel united. When the whole of South Africa came out during the Zuma Must Fall campaigns, when people had never marched before and decided to go and march, it was a huge step for South Africa. It wasn't a natural thing amongst all the cultures, and yet we were united. So they're those moments of unity that really, really make me proud. And finally, the third thing that always comes to the forefront. When there is a disaster, if someone needs help, the public, through the radio stations, come together and help, no matter who it is.
Mm.
And those are the principles of what I believe make us South Africans. I'm so proudly South African.
Thank you very much, Debbie. Beverly. That's it, Debbie. Thanks. So next.
I thought you were still going to mention what freedom was. It's fine. From my side, Mpumelelo Lali is the name. I do community development using sport as a tool. I train young people in different aspects. For me, what makes me proudly South African, I actually had written what my previous speaker had mentioned. But what I want to add to that, for me, is our natural beauty that we have as a country. Besides the people that are amazing, but just the flora, the fauna, if you drive around this beautiful country, for me, it makes me truly and proudly South African. And I wonder the news reports we get of people that are abusing funds of this country. I wonder, do they see this beauty and what it can actually mean for the rest of South Africa? So for me, to add, it's the beauty, it's the flora and fauna. For me, freedom means the desire and the opportunity to achieve my personal dreams and aspirations. And if I can do that, then for me, that's attainment of freedom.
Thank you very much, Mpumi. The good professor, Johan. Yeah. Let's just put the mic close to you, eh? Okay.
I'm an emeritus professor of Stellenbosch University in future studies. Therefore, I'm not anymore a professor at the university. Now, what is an emeritus? An emeritus professor is that is left over after 50 years of teaching.
Okay.
Now, that is my introduction. I'm now a wine farmer. Yeah, I'm not proud of South Africa, but I love the country and I love its people. This country needs some kind of initiative that people can really grow beyond just existing here, but living here in its full. And it's not happening at this moment, to say that. I have a long explanation of freedom here, and I cannot say it in one or two words. But personally, for freedom for me is to have a free ability to make a contribution and to enjoy the fruits of that contribution. Now, this is a much more complex, and I would like, if I have an opportunity, to explain it thoroughly, to link freedom with development and empathy and a lot of other things. But I'm not going to say more at this stage.
Prof, you must just keep the mic close to
okay,
you.
Okay, I will do that.
Speak. Okay, so colleagues, thanks very much for that opening remarks. So would you say that freedom has got to do with choice? Because, you know, if I'm free, I can choose. If I'm in the township school tonight, then there's 56 in a class. If I've got money in this country, I can go to a school where there's 30 or 25 in a class. Do you think it's got to do with choice? Or what do you think? Anyone can respond to that.
Well, definitely. So you must unpack freedom in itself. So there's freedom meaning the rule of law, accountability, the rights of your individual rights, surpasses group rights. So yes, once you have economic freedom and political freedom, you actually have the right to choice.
Mm.
If you cannot have, you can't just have political freedom and not economic freedom, then you have no choice. And then you can live the life you choose.
But that's exactly what the EFF is saying, is that you can't have, we've got political freedom, but you vote, and you stay poor.
Well, there's reasons for that.
Okay. Mpumi, you want to go?
Yes, for me, I think it's not by choice. We'd like it to be, but people are still governed by circumstance, by where you are born. The community that surrounds you sometimes does have a big impact. Luckily for me, I'm a product of a have. My grandparents were haves. My grandparents were economically free. At a time when it was not fashionable, so they had a history and of education and independence, and so that's the family legacy. So we've created that choice as a family over generations, and that has continued over time. And so I can proudly say yes, but I know a majority of people it's a big no.
Kevin, what do you think?
The issue of freedom as a psychological thing where you can do what you want is a blotch notion, because if you talk about emancipation of yourself, if you have to deal with the concept of freedom in your mind, then you will have people do whatever they want. There's always a framework in which you express your that you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, then the problem that we're sitting with in South Africa is that we sit with two generations of freedom thinkers, people who fought and brought this freedom here, and people who received and do not enjoy the benefits of that freedom. So you have this struggle between the two types of freedom. So when I meet military veterans at the castle, they will lament about this. We fought, but look here, they can't pay our pensions, they can't do this. When I meet youngsters, they say, oh, I have a degree, I have 2 degrees. You invite me as an intern at the castle, but you don't have an office and a PC and a phone for me. So that's the, it's almost that we need to recalibrate the entire 60 million of us to have some common notion of what freedom really means as a collective. And it deals with patriotism, it deals with, you know, worldview and all of that. So it's a very complex and a vexing question, and that's where you admitted today that we only will start this discussing it today. It needs to get into the schools. Boysai and Polis needs to have this kind of debate so that they get some commonality around that. I mean, you go into the bank and your compatriots are restless, behind you. Because in the past, they were standing in a separate line, a shorter line for you.
Mm.
So, that kind of almost freedom as a entitlement and freedom as a hard-won fought over 400 years of fighting against slavery, imperialism, and colonialism. So it's a very important question, and you summarize it, not yet Uhuru.
So earlier this week, on Sunday, I read in the Sunday Times a very catching headline that says, "Democracy is nice, Prof, but you can't eat it," said Mike Saluma, a journalist at Sunday Times. And it really resonated with me. You know, we've got these concepts of middle class and concept of what freedom is, but the majority of the people in this country continue to be poor. And the legacy of the law we've taken off the statutes, but the legacy of the law continues. How are we going to get this right? Prof, what do you say?
I would like to structure my answer a little bit. You started off also in your outline of this evening linking freedom with progress, economic progress, and said why is it so that we now worse off almost in terms of income distribution and so on than 21 years ago. Mm. Now, freedom is, and growth in freedom is a developmental process. Increasing the space in which you can exist, if you can put it this way. Now, what is development? Development normally is an improvement, is seen as an improvement in something. Education development, economic development, and so on. But development essentially is what happened to people, not to things. Development is something that happens when the ability and the desire of a person or a community increase increase it to serve their own needs, not to be dependent, and those of others. In other words, there's something communal as well as specific in the concept of development and its human center. Now, in terms of obstructions to freedom and development, I have five variables that I want to just present to you. The first is the quest for welfare, not to be poor. Mm. And the obstructions within this is poverty, inequality, and the fear of losing what you have. Three things. Then the next thing is the quest for knowledge and skills, the things that improve a person's ability to do things for him or herself and for his community and for his family. Now here we have again a lack of ability to gain these skills in inequality in the schooling system, education system, and so on, but also things like the home condition, what's happening in the community, and so on, lack of that, and then inequality, and also then the fear of losing that through technology or what something else. The third is the ability to participate, the political dimension, to be able to make a contribution in the political decision process. Now, democracy in a very equal type of society, not a sectarian society or a society of different ethnic groups and so on, is a very difficult concept. A majority rule is not democracy in such a society. So here you again may find yourself minority groups with a lack of that ability, and there's an inequality and a fear of losing it through all kinds of pressures. The fourth one is to be recognized as a person, as a human being, the ethical dimension, to be respected. If people look down on you, it's absent, it does something to your soul. And there again, you may feel that there's differences in society, upper class, lower class, or whatever. And you may feel also that you may lose this recognition. And the last one is something that people tend to ignore, and that is the quest for beauty, the quest for aesthetics, to live under conditions that is uplifting, to listen to music that is uplifting, not to live in a squatter camp where you have all the dirt around you. It is something that constrains your liberty. It's something that constrains your view of the world. Now, if this kind of situation in any country, and I fear that in South Africa that's more or less a situation, the first thing that happens is polarization within the community. Now, we had a polarized society to start off. and we had to decrease that polarization. But what happened in 1994 didn't remove the obstruction to polarization. As a matter of fact, it enhanced it. And there was a stage that people think that it's not the case, but it enhanced it. And then from polarization, you get alienation when people move out and say, well, I'm not part of this. I cannot be part of this. And then you have systemic corruption, like in South Africa. Now, my diagnosis for South Africa is that in terms of these criteria that I listed here, this country is in a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, but thanks for that input. Now, exactly on that point, you know, Professor Sam-Pieter Blans, in 1997 at the TRC, he was the first person to make an input there. He introduced the concept of a wealth tax. He said because of the vast distance between the haves and the have-nots and the never-hads, should we not have opted for a wealth tax to narrow this gap between the rich and the poor?
Well, the moment you do that, this country will go in a tailspin. I disagree totally with Sam-Pieter Blans.
Okay, Beverly, what do you say about the wealth tax to narrow this gap?
So I think we need to iron out, and when I talk about freedom, I talk about the principles of freedom and the principles of democracy, because they're the cornerstone of freedom for individuals. At the start of the new democracy, we didn't need a wealth tax. Everybody was quite willing to do their part. I mean, SARS was one of the best run tax companies in the world. Mm. We have degraded over a period of time. I'd say the single most policy that has destroyed this country is BEE, because it has been largely for a group of small insiders making some small group incredibly wealthy, billionaires, and the rest of the population incredibly poor. And I just want to read you the Palmer Index, which measures the distribution of incoming ratio between the richest 10% and the poorest 40%, is now the highest it's ever been in its history of unequal, the score of 7.5, one of the highest in the world. That didn't happen in 1995. That happened now. Mm. Our Gini coefficient has increased now. Our human development index has shown very little development. The fact that we've increased our welfare system to such a degree that our taxpayers can't actually cope, and we've actually made people dependent on the state, that was not where we were intending to go. So policies have a huge impact on freedom and the ability for people to get out of the poverty net. We always, and we support the poorest of the poor always having a social net. But we have failed South Africa as a population, as a group of people, as leaders and politicians, by not upskilling people enough, not giving opportunity, draconian policies that limit investment, tax laws. We should have put in tax systems, for example, that would incentivize companies to employ more people on some rebate. So it wasn't about putting a wealth tax and punishing one group for the other. It was really about all working together to create an enabling environment for jobs and economic growth. Mm.
But the policies of the last 20 odd years, 29 years, have brought us to this place. So I hear what you're saying is the erosion of institutions, the policy choices that we've made. I mean, it's under ANC-free government that we've had the most inequality that just continues. Calvin, what do you, wealth tax or not?
I'm coming to the wealth tax, but I think I'm always cautious about a historical judgment of where we are. Because if you remember before 1994, we were 13 countries that were brought together, Siskai, Botswana, Venda, Kwakwa, so, you know, they were even trying to make a colored homeland also. So you bring those disparate systems of people together, different systems of operating together, and you expect a magic wand. Also that the kind of metrics that you have in the former homelands and in white South Africa were totally different. So there's no way that you can could compare where we were in terms of that. I taught at the time comparative regional studies and socioeconomic geography, and we had access through the different NGOs, had access to the statistics. So you really have to do that if you want to make a fair term. I'm not defending what's happening now. I'm not defending the kind of polarization and marginalization that increased. But I'm saying that an Eskom now needs to give electricity to the 60 million people, where in the before 1994 it only gave electricity to 5 million people. I mean, I still grew up till my honors year with not electricity. I studied, under candles. So I think we must be very careful to try to say that the downward spiral were there, because otherwise we're not going to have a unified response to deal with if it's a spiraling down, to that spiraling down. But I don't believe it's a spiraling down. I believe that if we really engage the people on the ground, if we really forget this party political playing around with people's lives and saying that the focus should be on the 30 million people who are in destitute, then I think we will overcome some of these things. I think freedom for me is we can free those people. Otherwise, my electricity wall to keep those people out who are scratching my drums on Monday will be even higher and higher. Mm. So that's the challenge. I'm not defending corruption, because if I say if you steal 5 rand or 5 billion rand, it's the same. But how do you? And I didn't want to answer you deliberately about the wealth tax. I want to say the issue is the land, that we have done nothing about the land. Now we say, where are we going to put the things up that generates electricity or whatever? People don't have access to that. So deliberately, there's a systematically, and it's not a South African problem only, but globally, we have this disparity between the 5% of people who own the means of productions and the millions of people who are on the margins of that. I think that's the challenge. If we can internalize what's happening globally and bring it down here, but I have hope, because I see in my past 5 years or so, we're moving away from a unipolar world into a multi or bipolar world. At least there's hope for me to deal with the challenges that we have.
Okay, if you just tuned in, you're listening to KC 107.7. We were the chairman's conversations, courageous conversations, and we're inviting you to participate. You can either participate on our Facebook page, or you can drop us a WhatsApp. And we can also invite the studio audience to also, if they've got a question or two, shortly we're going to ask them to also participate. So if you'd like to ask a question to the panel, please indicate to Austin and he'll hand you the mic. So I'm going to ask one question, and then we're going to, if you've got a question, you can start preparing yourself. Now, I want to come back to democracy. You know, this democracy, if you look at China, for example, it's not a democracy. If you look at Singapore, it's not a democracy in the purest form. Neither is Rwanda, and yet these kind. If you look at China, I read the other day, China is producing more research outputs and registering patents, much more, at a much higher level than we. So is this democracy working? Shouldn't we, we can't eat it. We consult. And yet it seems to favor a very small, narrow group. The signs are there. I put it to you as a good lawyer. The signs are there. This democracy is not working for the people of South Africa. Prof, what do you say?
Well, we don't have the democracy in South Africa in the truest sense.
What do we have then?
We have the autocracy of the majority. The fact of the matter is, with a very divided society, the great majority, which is ethnically entrenched, will always put their affairs in front of the broader country's affairs. For example, if the president of the ANC, as the president of South Africa, talk about my people, who are his people? I don't know. My suspicion is I'm not part of that. And I think that many people feel like that in the Western Cape, especially. So we do not have democracy. Democracy, if you want to read something about the logic of democracy, read a book by Tullock and Buchanan called The Calculus of Consent. It explains exactly what democracy should be in a society like South Africa. But majority rule is not democracy in South Africa.
Okay. Do we have a mic there for Eva? Not yet? Okay. You want to answer? Probably I want to answer that. Do we have this democracy or not?
So for me, I think we have the foundations of democracy. I think if you look at the political democracy, the right to vote, the freedom of expression, so we have the basic foundations, but I think that's where it had stopped. So if I make an analogy of a house, we in the 80s, I think we were digging the trenches for this building. In the 90s, the foundations were being laid. I think it had stopped there at the foundation level. So for me, I think the foundation is starting to crack, and it needs to be relooked if we're going to build this house. I think we have strong enough foundations as a start to look at, but it still is. It needs leadership, and sadly, the reports we have about current leadership is not one of boldness, of taking decisions that people feel that things are happening. Still, we are in an era where presidents are seemingly protecting wrongdoing countless and number again. We talked about 9 wasted years. I guess we're going to talk about 18 wasted years moving forward. So we continue to have leaders that support their political structures because they've put them there, but at the expense of South Africans, sadly.
Okay. So thanks for that, Mpumi. We're going to ask Ephraim Gordon. You would like to ask a question from our studio audience.
Hi, just a remark. First of all, I think for any conversation of progress to have any legitimacy is like when we treat alcoholism or addiction. You must admit that there is a problem. And if I look at the panel, the only person who's actually admitted his privilege is the brother in the black shirt who came out here and said he comes from a privileged background. Now, if we looked at that, considering that we're in the Western Cape, that brother is probably the last brother we thought who would come with the admission that he comes from a privileged background. Unless we all admit our privilege, we can never ever admit, or we can never ever have a hand in any form of redress. Because redress requires two things. It requires the poorest of the poor to understand that they are poor, but it requires the wealthiest of the wealthy to understand that they are wealthy and what that wealth means. Which brings me then to democracy. Democracy will never work in a country such as ours where everyone is not on the same level of education.
Okay. All right. What are your thoughts on that comment? Thanks for that, Ephraim.
Sorry, this is a question, but anyway.
The issue of democracy, first of all, if you had a protected struggle for freedom and for liberation, and you get to a point where the enemy and the protagonist and antagonist gets to a point where they put down the weapons and they negotiate a settlement, then there are compromises. So I agree with Prof. Spies. Our democracy, I agree with him that our democracy is not working. But I don't agree for the same reasons. I say because if you want, and again my question of 13 different countries, bringing them together suddenly into one, and the masses of people who don't have a natural concept of constitutional democracy, they have democracy in terms of the M-plan. The M-plan says there will be street committees, house committees, there will be representatives on the shop floor, etc. There was that kind of democracy. But a negotiated, compromised democracy like ours, all of those things, the new goes into the old. So it's a continuation of the old. You know, you've changed the stuff that they're working with. You put a little bit of African on there. But in essence, the parliament that was in the castle and then moved to Plain Street is essentially the same structures. And I have it on record that I said, for the first 10 years, what we should have is some China, Cuban, whatever, centralized democracy to cultivate a spirit of newness, of rejuvenation, of patriotism, etc. So if I have to live this
moment of democracy and freedom over, that is what I would insist if I have the power still and less gray hairs to do that. But as I say, I remain hopeful that we will move into that era if people on the ground takes the process forward.
Beverly?
Dr. Kluter, yeah, I don't agree with all the sentiment, although I have a deep respect for opinion. I think what worries me tremendously now, more than ever, is we're seeing a diminishing of democracy as we know it across the world. Let me tell you one thing. Once your democracy or your freedom, if you voluntarily give up your freedom and your rights, government does not give it back to you very easily. In fact, we have a history of that where you've had to fight for that. People have died in the name of bringing democracy to South Africa, and we are so wanting to give it back quite easily. And I've seen the change. I mean, if you just think of accountability, a democratic principle, which is failing in South Africa. So if you're saying, is democracy working? I'd say democracy is a process. It's not an end journey. Somebody said, put your seatbelts. Democracy is a journey. Put your seatbelt on and hang on for dear life. It's a rough ride. If you look in the world, Europe, they went through many wars. Many people died in the name of democracy. We are a young, young democracy. We struggle still to keep the rule of law, to have accountability amongst politicians, for people to go to jail who steal money from the people. These are principles we haven't reached our end goal yet. So we need to fight for democracy. We cannot be giving it up at this point. We won't get it back. It took a long time to get it back here in South Africa.
Thanks, Bev. We've got 20 minutes left. I didn't factor in load shedding at 8 here in Paul. So we've got 20 minutes left here. We've got one question, one more question.
Can I answer react to that comment?
Yeah.
You remember?
On the privilege.
On what I will call consciousness.
Yeah.
Now, the other evening we had a discussion about this. And my... argument or my statement was that in South Africa there's a lack of social conscience, not conscience, conscience.
Gewete.
Ja, gewete. Now, for that, the first requirement is that they must develop a consciousness, an awareness of the social condition. That is an essential quality. So I agree with what you said. I think it's absolutely necessary. There must be an awareness of the collective and what is happening in the collective. Without that, we cannot build. And we know that wealth is not in money or in capital goods and so on. Wealth is in human capital and in social capital. Human capital is what is in the person, and that I've defined it. Social capital is in the social cohesion. And unless we can build, we can never be, or unlikely that we will be ever a nation, but we can become a community in this country, people working together to do things. But to do that, perhaps my argument will be, it should be from the bottom up and not from the top down. People at the local level should understand each other and start working together and start doing and solving the problems of communities.
Thanks.
So in reaction to what you said.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask you later just to share with the audience the work that you involved with locally that proves exactly that point. We had a question, I think Mike Fraser there at the back had a question there. First Ralph. Ralph and then Mike.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Kluter. I just want to say that we should be more robust in terms of approach, of our approach to democracy. We must mean what we say and say what we mean. You know, if you look at composers and singers and what they are portraying, guys like Bob Marley that we all know, he is saying, how long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? And some say it's just a part of it. Peter Tosh, for instance, is saying, I'm not here to live up to your expectation. Neither are you here to live up to mine. I am what I am. I am, I am, I am. And I think we should respect that. If I look at two principles in terms of our society, like mining, we've got, you know, from gold to platinum to whatever. But the human rights is saying those who work the land, they should be sharing in the profits and the wealth. How come that a country in South Africa where the masses are, you know, very poor, and if you look at the shareholding, for instance, and you can take Anglo-American, De Beers, Billiton, all these shareholders are either, you know, foreigners, British, from, you know, down under. Where are we in that space? If you look at sports, I mean, we all are passionate about sports. Religion, for instance, where do we fit in the youth? And we want to make rules for the youth without them, you know, having a legitimate share and say what they feel. And I think the whole question of democracy says we need to challenge the status quo. Irrespective, you know, the matter must stand above the personality. I still respect you, but I've got the freedom of I can differ and I can say how I feel, and there should be an appreciation from the other side. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that comment, Ralph. Mike Fraser?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've noted down my comments, what I would like to say. The question tonight is, has freedom delivered on its promise? And I think before we can answer this important question about our freedom, we need to clarify what this freedom was all about. We need to clarify the question, freedom from what? In my opinion, it is freedom from a long, hard and resilient struggle against an evil, brutal and violent system of apartheid oppression and discrimination and dispossession. It is freedom from a system that was intentional and structural in its design and implementation to provide privilege to a few South Africans at the expense of the majority of their fellow South Africans, based on nothing else but a false sense of superiority, which in fact is a sense of fear and insecurity, and actually a sense of inferiority. And they went on to offer religious justification for this evil system, which was declared a crime against humanity. They introduced a raft of laws to ensure that this system would be firmly implemented, and they used violent force in the process. And this system caused so much harm and damage to the citizens of our beloved country, and the damage is almost irreversible. And then the second question, we also need to clarify the promise of our freedom. The promise of our freedom is a better life for all. And that is why we were so happy and proud when our liberation movements were unbanned and the political prisoners were released from prison and our fellow South Africans returned home after spending many years in exile. And that is why we were so happy and proud when most of us could go to the polls and cast our vote for the first time in our lives on that day of 27 April 1994. And thereafter, we were tasked to start rebuilding the country of our dreams, the country of our hopes and aspirations for equality, for restoring human dignity, for reconciliation, social cohesion, and nation building. And most of us, many of us, looked forward to the redress and the reparation that would come from the many forced removals and separation of families and communities that were imposed on us. However, when you look back at the euphoria of the advent of our freedom in 1994, the hopes and dreams of our freedom, and the erosion of those hopes and dreams over these years brings about a very deep, sad disappointment in my heart and in my soul. And I think we must also not just look at governments and politicians to restore the promise of our freedom. We also need to look at ourselves at a personal level. What are we doing as community members in our families, in our communities, in society? What are we doing in terms of just being a fellow South African? Because that is where the promise of our freedom can rise from. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike, for that input. We've got 10 minutes left, colleagues, before load sharing. And so I think Mike steered it into that direction. Local action. We know what is wrong. We spend a lot of time what is wrong. What is it that we can do as a local radio station? We are all locals here. We all live here in this area. What can we do, or what should we do to build this community that Professor Spies talked about, you know? Ideas, colleagues, inputs. Mpumi?
Yo, I like the previous speaker because he is passionate about the rights of individuals. And in my journey of talking to young people, they don't see that. They don't have a clue of what it means to vote. They actually don't care. And for me, this is the sad part in our democracy, is that we have people that are still alive that cherish this value of this idea of a vote because it expresses something in me. But we have a youth that sees that as nothing. And for me, those two different understandings, that's where we need to close that gap. Mm. The individual that is passionate needs to speak to the young person who says, I don't care, and looks them in the eye and says, look at me. It means for me.
So I summarize that as civic education. We should be involved with civic education and generational discussions. Kelvin?
I'm Mr. Sam Gordon. Eh?
Yeah, Ephraim.
I want to commend them for asking, because privilege is not only about wealth, and as the professor say, about, say, whiteness and being in a position. Privilege is also like me, to have lived through the 76 and the outrage after Steve Biko, Kosas Formation in 79, the school boycotts of the 80s, and then the turn of events in the mid-80s. But you know this Madala is still working, so what I'm doing, the privilege of living through that, and the experience of living through that, although I don't spend much time in my hometown, I do it there. So for instance, on Pumi, to get back to you on Freedom Day, with the IEC is bringing school kids and young youth, 18 years plus, to the castle to do a mock vote for them after they've been conscientized. What is the word that you use? Yeah, conscientize them and then mobilize them towards understanding the importance of that vote. Mm-hmm. But I certainly think on this side, all of us have almost a revolutionary duty to bring the youth of the western side of the river and the eastern side of the river together. I think it's important. In the height of apartheid, there were forums, what was it called, the PDF, the Paul Development Forum, where when the Caspers were standing in the gates of Makueni or Paul East, communities came together and discussed what, you know, the future of this country. But as the Prof also said, it seems to me that we've moved further away from each other. So it's the duty of everybody, Mike, myself, Ephraim, in his acting capacity, to again invest some more in our communities. And I know if PAL and this area leads, then the rest of the country follows. So it's very important that we revisit our patriotic responsibility to get the youngsters engaged. That's the one thing. The other thing is there are no intergeneration discussions anymore, unless this thing is an old thing. Because there's a lot of intergenerational discussion between the youth and this thing called, what do they call this thing? Smartphone.
Yeah.
But I think if we can replace this with a Mike or a Harlan or a Ralph or whatever, and get some 5 or 10 youngsters from Polis or from Boys of Gymnasium and talk about these experiences, then I think they will be understanding. Because now everything divides us. Load shedding divides us. This divides us. You know, food parcels divides us. SASA divides. Everything divides us. But there are things that unite us, as Beverly said earlier. And we need to come back. If I have more time next year, then okay. I certainly will do my part here. Yeah.
Okay, so there's a second idea that we put to Casey. Facilitate a discussion between the West and the East. You know, it's almost like West Germany and East Germany. But let's facilitate the discussion between the West and the East. Beverly?
I think leading on from that and from what Mike, you're very, you know, we need more role players, more leaders, mentors. You're a mentor for your community. You're a mentor. I live in Paul now. I'm a proud Paulian. And it's God's best kept secret, actually. Let's find role models. There are not enough role models. We used to have Mandela was our role model, you know, for the world. So let's discover, let's create role models. Our youth needs role models. The easiest role models are usually in sport, and that's a very, very important part, and that's why Paul has this wonderful, wonderful hiss that you can't find in many other places because of the sport that it holds. But role models is absolutely key.
Wonderful. I would just before I forget, on Freedom Day, 9 o'clock the morning at the Arboretum, there's a walk organized by the Isibani Social Investment Club. It's a group of young people, and they've got a youth league, and they're organizing a walk for the community. And I invite everybody, all of you, to walk the talk. Come and walk with us. Casey is a proud partner to that event. And that's also a practical thing where you can connect and meet people. So it's 30 Rand for adults and 10 Rand for children to come and walk. It's the community in action. Okay, any other ideas? So we've got a second idea. We're going to walk. We're going to have East-West discussion. We're going to have civic education discussion. Any other bright ideas that you may have? To get us going 5 minutes before load shedding goes. Prof, just tell us about the work that you've been doing.
Only simple ideas.
Yeah.
You can start by cleaning up some of Paul East, for example.
Hmm.
Make it beautiful.
In Rwanda, they do that once a month. Every Saturday, once a month in a Saturday, it's clean up day. So like we have our Mandela Day on the 18th of July, they do it every month on a Saturday. Everybody gets involved with civic action, yeah. Either cleaning or, and I think that is really commendable.
And the second one, I would like to focus on the youth. As you know, the Paul Youth Initiative is already running, and we had these farmer kids already through university and so on. So you focus on youth. But I would also like to see in the Paul a technical high school. That's a project that can bring big business and ordinary community people together. These days, a plumber can earn more than a hard shearer.
Hmm. Thank you for that. So that is an idea. We must never underestimate the power of ideas. We've voiced ideas, yeah? And I think the next step for us is to take our ideas to implementation and then to impact. And with our collective effort and the collective will that we've picked up here this evening, that has really been very, very good for the soul. I read a definition the other day of pragmatism, which really I found fascinating. They say if it's a white cat or a black cat, it doesn't matter. If the cat can catch mice, it's a good cat. And yeah, so I think we are at that point in our history now. Of pragmatism. Yeah. I don't think it's about ideology anymore. Calvin, what do you think? It's about, does it work?
You see, the problem with ideology is that the ideologues have abandoned that already. Mm. And it's us, the followers, who are still clinging on ideology. And that's the problem. But I think before
Eskom throw us the Prince of Darkness. I think I want to say that Mike has summarized this whole thing because we don't want to deviate. I mean, you are at implementation of practical things out of this discussion because we can't come and sit and drink up your water and eat your cake and walk. But I think it's important to just crown this thing of freedom. You know, in 76, on the Bold and Polis, we sang this thing, freedom, you know, about freedom. Freedom is not free. You have to pay the price. You have to sacrifice for your liberty. Mm. The same thing that people confuse freedom and democracy. Democracy is just one arm of freedom. It's the formalization of freedom. And if you don't internalize, if you not internalize all these things that people say constitutes freedom, and you make it your own, you will never be free. You will always be a captive. You will always be somebody else's slave, whether it's, I almost said Donald Trump, what is his thing, Elon Musk, or whoever these people are making things. You will always be a slave because you haven't liberated yourself in body, mind, and spirit. So that's my last contribution.
Thank you very much, colleagues. I would like to just say thank you very much to our panel, our esteemed panel, for your participation, to our audience. A special word of thanks to Noshad Khan, our GM, together with the technical team for making all of this possible this evening. We've got lots of food for thought. Like Calvin said, it's not about talking. We'll take this discussion tonight, try and summarize it, and then hold all of us accountable to that, you know, to say what is it that we're going to do next, to make sure that it just doesn't stay at ideas, but that we implement and then eventually make an impact. Thank you so much for your attendance. God bless you and travel safe. Thank you. Thank you.